Ecclesiastes was kind of an interesting book. It stands out among the books of the Bible because it has a rather cynical, pessimistic point of view compared to a lot of what you usually read, but that is because Solomon is looking at wisdom from a purely worldly perspective and recognizing how empty it all is from that perspective. Tonight we have another book by Solomon, and this one is also pretty unique among the books of the Bible. It's called Song of Solomon, or also just called Song of Songs. In the Hebrew Bible, when you see something called like Song of Songs, King of Kings, Holy of Holies, that means it is the greatest example of that thing. So Song of Songs, it is the greatest of the songs that Solomon wrote. And Song of Solomon, or Song of Songs, is a love poem or a series of closely connected love poems, and it celebrates romance and sexuality, though in poetic symbolic language rather than graphic descriptions. So this isn't a pornographic Harlequin novel, though it is surprising for a book of the Bible. It's not what you expect the first time you come across it. In fact, in Jewish society, there were age restrictions on who could read this book. Apparently, in some ultra-Orthodox circles, you weren't even allowed to read it until you're 30 years old or married. The subject matter tonight is, you could say, PG-13 level or so. Because again, this is a book that celebrates romance and sexuality. A lot of the imagery in the book, especially the parts where the lovers praise each other, some of it comes off sound kind of odd to us. For example, in chapter 1, verse 9, you have this compliment. It says, "I liken you, my darling, to a mare among Pharaoh's chariot horses." Not too many women would be very pleased if their husband or boyfriend told them they looked like a horse. So some of the imagery, the compliments come off not sounding much like compliments in our culture. But what is going on is that a lot of these compliments reference characteristics other than appearance. What other characteristics of a horse might be Solomon be trying to reference other than appearance? Because I doubt he's calling her saying that she looks like a horse. Maybe strength, courage, grace, bravery, some of those kind of things. So sometimes as we read through the book of Song of Solomon's, we just have to accept that the compliments are compliments, even if we don't quite get what's going on. Poetry is notoriously difficult to translate from one language to another, so we do lose a little bit in translation. As far as the flow of the poem, it is a little bit hard to figure out. There are a couple possibilities. Well, there's more than a couple possibilities. Every commentary you read will have their own outline of it, and so a lot of them look nothing alike. But I'll give you two what I think are the two best possibilities of what's out there. And a lot of people suggest that there is kind of a progression in the book that starts out with the idea of courtship, and it goes on to the wedding night, and on from there to a deepening of the marriage relationship, and wraps up with kind of a conclusion and epilogue. And you can see there on the screen, it's divided chapter 1:1 through 3:5, 3:6 through 5:1, 5:2 through 8:4, 8:5 through 14. I've borrowed this from the Bible Knowledge Commentary. You'll see a lot of similar schemes to breaking down this, that this is more or less how the book progresses. It might be correct, but it also might be trying to impose a little too detailed of a structure on the book, because it seems to really require some fancy footwork to maintain that the relationship is chaste and pure before marriage. There's some stuff in chapters 1 through 3 that don't sound like just courtship. Example, talking about our bed in chapter 1, verse 16. So another possible structure to the book, and this one I think works a little bit better, but take your pick. You can read through it yourself and decide. But another possible structure of the book is, and this is one that I heard from one of my seminary professors, and I can't remember which one, or I'd give him credit, but someone I had in seminary. This was his analysis of how the book flowed, and it makes good sense as you read through the book, is that there are several cycles of the couple being apart, and while they're apart, longing for one another, including remembering past events from their relationship, and then ending with them reuniting, including the physical relationship and everything that goes with that. So rather than a strict progression from start of the relationship through however far the book goes, it's kind of a series of cycles during their married life. There are a number of main characters in the book of Song of Songs. And the first one is often called the Shulamite. She is a shepherdess. Shulamite probably is referring to where she's from. But again, every commentator has a different idea of where she's from, whether it's some unknown town called Shulam, or if it's another name for the known town of Shunem, or if it's another name for Jerusalem, which is sometimes called Salem. It doesn't really matter, but that is what she's called. She's a shepherdess. In chapter 1, verses 5 through 8, we find out that she has been forced to work in the vineyard and tend the sheep, and she seems a bit self-conscious about the fact that she is dark and tanned. You know, in our culture, people like to be tan and go out intentionally tanning. In that culture, you wanted to be as light as possible because that meant you got to stay inside and, you know, you were rich and didn't have to work. So she mentions a couple times that she's dark-skinned, and that doesn't necessarily mean that she's from anywhere outside of Israel. It just means she's been out working in the fields. The second character is her beloved, who appears to be a shepherd in chapter 1 and verse 7. Her beloved, this shepherd, is also generally believed to be King Solomon, who did in fact own many sheep. Ecclesiastes 2:9, among when he's talking about the pleasures and riches that he had, he mentions owning lots of sheep. And it is possible that Solomon disguised himself as a common shepherd to woo this woman. Some people think that Solomon is a completely separate character from the shepherd, who woos her away from the shepherd, and then you get really complicated readings of the book. And the reason some people think that is, well, how many wives did Solomon have? Yeah, about 1,000. 700 official wives and 300 sort of kind of wives. So some people looking at Solomon read this love poetry and say, how could someone like that be writing about a unique, romantic, beloved person, as these love poems indicate? And I still think it's Solomon. There's a couple ways to address that. The first is that this might be his first wife, or one of his first wives, at least, before he's fallen deep into polygamy. This is one of his first genuine romantic attachments. It might also be that this is being written after he's gone into polygamy, because there is a mention of queens and concubines in chapter 6, verses 8 and 9. And maybe this is just, I don't know, number one wife. This is the wife with whom he has an actual romantic attachment, rather than a lot of his marriages were just political alliances. So maybe this is, you know, the one wife whom he actually loved. Yeah, and I think there's some of that going on, could be some of that going on too. So I take it as this is, her beloved is Solomon throughout the book. There isn't a beloved and a Solomon, that they're the same person. Like I said, you can find commentators that'll spin it some other way, and it's possible they're right. We're going with a simpler explanation because I think it works. The next set of characters, if you call them that, is the other people or friends, oftentimes addressed as the daughters of Jerusalem, so the women who live in Jerusalem. And they are kind of there as someone for the Shulamite to speak to when Solomon's not around. They're kind of a way to carry the story forward, someone for her to share her thoughts with, someone to kind of provide a little bit of narration to what's going on. In ancient plays and poetry, a lot of times there was a group called the chorus, and their job was there to narrate and to respond to the characters. And the Daughters of Jerusalem seem to kind of have that function in this set of love poems. And someone who's surprisingly not really in these poems is God. There is not, the only verse that directly mentions the name of God, and it's debatable whether it does or not, it could be translated a couple ways, is chapter 8 and verse 6, where God's name appears describing the intensity of flame. So it's just as part of a description. And like I said, it can be translated a couple different ways. It might not even be about God. He doesn't really appear by name in the book. It's kind of like Esther, like that. Esther is the one other book where the name of God doesn't appear at all. And God seems to be more in the background, behind the scenes in this one, and there's probably a reason for that that we'll get to as we go a little further on. There is one place where the narrator may be God speaking, and again, we'll get to that a little bit further on. So most English translations have headings or notes in the margins that give you an idea of who is speaking in each part of the poem, because it goes back and forth and back and forth. And it's not always real easy to tell who it is that's speaking, because some of the clues that would let us know who it is don't translate well from Hebrew into English. So our Bible translators have conveniently labeled for us who it is that's speaking. Those labels aren't infallible and inspired, but they're generally right. There's very little disagreement on most of them. The ones where they sometimes disagree is whether it's Solomon speaking or the group of friends speaking. But in general, we have labeled who it is that's speaking. And then we come to how to interpret this book, because like I said, it's very different from the rest of what you're going to find in the Bible. It is love poetry, and there's two main ways that people have interpreted this book. And the first one is, could be called the allegorical or typological. These are two separate things, but they're basically the same. Allegorical or typological interpretation. And that is where it basically says that the main purpose of this book, of this love story, is to represent the love of God for Israel or of Christ for the church. And everything throughout the poems is then interpreted to be in some way about God and Israel or Christ and the church. Allegorical means that the story itself is completely made up. It's like a parable or a fable. Typological means, yes, we do believe that the story and the things that are in it actually happened, but the point is what's behind them. The point is Christ and the church. The point is Israel and God. This has been by far the most popular view down through history. The Jewish rabbis tended to hold it. The Catholic Church tended to hold it. Conservative Protestants tended to hold it. And the main reason for it seems to be not necessarily anything in the book that suggests that it's allegorical, but the fact that this is a book of erotic love poetry dropped in the middle of the Bible, and it confuses us, so we have to come up with some way to spiritualize it. And on the Roman Catholic side, there might be some possibility also that because they consider sexuality to be somehow dirty or disgraceful, they really can't have that in the Bible. So they really have to come up with some way to spiritualize this love poetry. And some attempts to try and to give you some examples of what it looks like when they allegorize it. In chapter 1, verses 5 through 6, where it talks about when the shepherd girl talks about being dark and having dark skin because of working in the sun. They say, well, see, that represents the darkness of original sin on the church, but Jesus loves her anyway and rescues her and purifies her. And that's probably the most believable of the allegorizations. It gets sillier from there. Chapter 2, verse 12, when it talks about cooing of doves, well, that must be the preaching of the gospel throughout the world. Chapter 5, verse 1, when it talks about eating together, well, that must be the Lord's Supper. You know, people who are really into allegorical interpretation, anytime they come across anyone eating, oh, that must be the Lord's Supper. It must be communion. And anytime there's a mention of a tree and there's a couple different parts in the poetry that mentions trees, oh, that has to be the cross. And a tree is automatically a cross in allegorical interpretation. So that pops up a few times. In one of the worst ones, the physical description of the Shulamite in chapter 7, verses 1 through 9, which I'm not going to read aloud because it would make me blush, because it is some of the more obvious sexual description in the book, is said to represent the fine raiment of the church. Go ahead and read through it later, and it is not. And I forgot to grab it. I have a commentary where he goes on and on about how it's fine raiment, and it's just kind of sad. The allegorical interpretation really doesn't work. The two main problems is, like I said, there's absolutely nothing in the book itself that suggests that it's meant to be allegorical, that it's meant to have some sort of deeper meaning about God and Israel or Christ and the church. Well, it's certainly not Christ and the church because it's Old Testament. The church isn't around until the New Testament. But there isn't even anything that suggests that it's supposed to be primarily about God and Israel. And a problem that you come across with allegorical interpretation wherever it happens is that it's so subjective. You can make the Bible say practically anything that you want when you look at it with allegorical interpretation. Like I said, anytime you see food, it suddenly becomes the Lord's Supper. Anytime you see a tree, it suddenly becomes the cross. There's just no safeguards on it. You can start making the Bible say all kinds of stuff. And sometimes when people do allegorical interpretation, the things they say aren't wrong, you know, as in theologically wrong, but they're certainly not what that part of the Bible is talking about. They're preaching truth from something that isn't talking at all about that part of the truth. So even though that is the most popular way of interpreting the Bible, and a lot of commentaries you pick up, especially if they weren't written in the last 20, 30 years, will take that form of interpretation. A better way is probably the historical interpretation, which just says we take the poems at face value. They are a celebration of romantic love and marriage, and that includes sexuality. And the question then is, well, why, if they're just love poems, why would God include that in the Bible? Like I said, if you're not expecting them and you come across them, you know, you've been reading Ecclesiastes and it's all this deep philosophy, and all of a sudden you get to Song of Solomon 1:2, let him kiss me with the kisses of his mouth, you go, whoa, wait, what? Well, the reason these are in the Bible is it is a celebration of what God has designed. God is the one who designed marriage. You know, what's the first thing that God said was not good? Yeah, it's not good for man to be alone. He looks at Adam. Adam's by himself, says, that's not good. And he makes Eve and institutes marriage. And the sexual relationship within marriage is a part of that. And it's something that God designed. It's something that's good. It's approved by God. If you want to read more verses on your time, again, I'm not going to read them. You can go back and read them. Proverbs 5, verses 15 through 20, you get very similar subject matter to what you're going to find in Song of Solomon. God approves of romantic love. God approves of sexuality within marriage, when used as he designed it to be used. And not only is it a celebration, oh, and let's see, there's one verse in that regard, Hebrews 13:4. Marriage should be honored by all, the marriage bed kept pure, for God will judge the adulterers and all the sexually immoral. So you got to contrast sexuality within marriage to any other sexuality that's out there. And not only is it a celebration of what God has designed, it is a demonstration of what romantic love should be. And these two people in this poem are very much in love with each other, very much obsessed with each other romantically. It is only a reflection of God and Israel or Christ in the church in the sense that certain aspects of any good marriage are a reflection of certain aspects of God's relationship with Israel or Christ's relationship with the church. When God calls himself Israel's husband, however, the focus is on faithfulness and provision. When God compares marriage to Christ and the church, the focus is on self-sacrificing love and submission. Those aren't really the things that Song of Solomon is focused on. Song of Solomon is focused on romantic attraction and physical intimacy. So it is not a very direct reflection of Christ and the church, not a very direct reflection of God in Israel. If you want that kind of metaphor, Book of Hosea, God in Israel. Ephesians chapter 5, verses 25 and following, Christ and the church as a reflection of marriage, as a reflection of Christ and the church. But that's not the focus to these poems. These are very romantic poems. As far as the content theology goes, I'm not going to be reading large chunks of this to you. Go home and read it on your own. Actually, go home and read it with your spouse. Let's do that. And as far as content theology, these can basically be enjoyed purely as romantic poetry. That's one of the main reasons they're there. You know, stop trying to spiritualize it. Go home, read it with your spouse by candlelight. Probably the reason that God is not directly mentioned is that even though sexuality is good, sorry, and is designed by God, it is not meant to be used as a ritual for worshiping him. And that is something that was easily confused for the people of Israel, because the Canaanite culture that they lived in the middle of did use sex as a ritual for worshiping their gods. So throughout the Old Testament, sexuality and ritual worship are kept very much separate, which is probably one reason why God is kept in the background of this. But as we as you read through Song of Solomon, it can tell us what romantic love should look like. There's a few themes that come up over and over again. Like I said, it's kind of a cycle that happens several times throughout the book. Some of the things that tells us about romantic love is that it causes a longing to be together. And I have there some references in that regard. 2:10 through 13, 3:1 through 2. Talk about when the couple are separated, they have a strong desire to be back together. And, you know, it's a reminder to regularly set other things aside to fulfill the need for each other's company, rather than kind of slowly smothering that desire by never spending any time together. To not let the busyness of life turn you and your spouse into little more than roommates who share some shared responsibilities but are almost completely independent of each other the rest of the time. God designed marriage so that we wouldn't be alone. Again, Genesis 2:18, it is not good for man to be alone. So those of us who are married, we need to make time to be with our spouse, to spend time with them. It's why we got married. Hopefully it was to be together. And we can't let the busyness of life let it drive us apart and rob us of that joy, and even rob us of that desire if we squash it down and push it away for too long. Romantic love also views the other person as beautiful and desirable and tells them so. And a couple passages in that regard, chapters 1, verses 2 through 4, chapter 7, verses 1 through 9. And attraction includes both their physical appearance, which gets emphasized a lot in the Book of Song of Solomon. It's that kind of love poem. But it also includes being attracted to their character, to who they are. The Shulamite, when she's talking about Solomon, in verse 3, talks about how much she values and loves his name. And in the Bible, when it talks about someone's name, that doesn't mean, that necessarily that she likes the sound of the name Solomon. It means all that you are. Your name is your character. It is how people know you to be. So you're attracted to the person not just in their appearance, but in their character as well. And if you're married, you need to tell your spouse that regularly. There's a joke I consider a pretty unfunny joke where a wife is upset because her husband never tells her that he loves her, and his response is, "Well, I told you I loved you when I married you, and I'll tell you now. I'll let you know if it changes." That is not the way to keep romance alive. Yeah. That's going to do quite the opposite. Romantic love is fed by telling the other person how much you love them and why you love them. Romantic love is also joyfully approved of by God. He designed it. He's the one that invented the companionship of marriage. And there's very interesting, not even a full verse, a fragment of a verse right towards the middle of the book. In chapter 5, and the last couple phrases of verse 1. And it comes at the end of a particularly, let's say, intense passage that's identified by many people as the wedding night. And after that, an unidentified, you could say, narrator voices approval and encouragement of the couple. And this is what I said. It says, "Eat, friends, and drink. Drink your fill of love." An expression of approval, of encouragement. And this isn't the husband speaking. It's not the wife speaking. They are intimately alone, so it's not the daughters of Jerusalem speaking, unless they're peeping toms. This is the narrator. And the narrator appears to be expressing divine blessing on their relationship. God designed romantic love. God designed the marriage relationship. God heartily approves of and encourages a husband and wife to be romantically in love with one another. We shouldn't be like the medieval Roman Catholic Church and others who viewed any sort of physical relationship as basically a necessary evil and thought that the only purpose for the sexual relationship was to create children and it's a sin to enjoy it for any other purpose. That comes from a very pagan way of thinking that says that anything physical is automatically evil, that spirit good, physical bad. That's not Christianity. That's Gnosticism. That's Greek philosophy. We are designed to have a material part the body and an immaterial part the soul spirit. They work together. God created both. Both are good. Now, this fallen world has twisted both of them to a degree, but but God clearly approves of romance, including the physical relationship. And that also means that we shouldn't be like those who look down on romantic love. In Bible college, once you get out of your freshman year, you kind of look at a lot of the Bible college freshmen as being real know-it-alls. They get a little bit of Bible knowledge and think that they know it all, and think that they can, not all of them, but can develop a very holier-than-thou attitude. And one thing I remember seeing a lot in Bible college was those who had just gotten really puffed up with all the new Bible knowledge they had started being really down on romantic love. Because, you know, biblical love is the conscious decision to put someone else's good ahead of your own, sometimes even when you don't feel like it. And that's very true. If you look at the definition of biblical love, that is basically what it boils down to. 1 Corinthians 13 is all about, you know, treating others how we want to be treated, putting others ahead of ourselves. But that does not mean that love does not include feelings and emotions of being in love with your spouse. That does not mean that we should look down on romantic love. Those feelings and emotions of being in love with the right person, those feelings are a gift from God. They're something that he created. They're something that he heartily approves of. And just because Satan has often managed to twist those emotions or get people to apply them to the wrong person does not mean that they are sinful, does not mean that they are irrelevant when they're directed towards the right person, towards your spouse. The book wraps up in verses chapter 8, verses 6 and 7, with a description of how powerful love is. And this is includes the one verse where God's name may be mentioned, depending on how the translators translate it. Chapter 8, verses 6 and 7. It says, "Place me like a seal over your heart, like a seal on your arm. For love is stronger than is as strong as death. It's jealousy unyielding as the grave. It burns like blazing fire, like a mighty flame, or like the very flame of the Lord. Many waters cannot quench love. Rivers cannot sweep it away. If one were to give all the wealth of one's house for love, it would be utterly scorned." The book ends with the point that true love is powerful and unquenchable and of infinite value. You can't buy it. It is not something to be forced or played around with before the proper time, and that warning comes up several times throughout the book of Song of Solomon, chapter 2, verse 7, chapter 3, verse 5, chapter 8, verse 4, all contain the exact same warning to not awaken love before the right time. Because love, and the focus here is on romantic love, is powerful, is unquenchable, is of infinite value. And treating romantic love in a way that God did not intend brings sorrow and regret. Solomon himself found that out. And he began collecting wives. Like I said, he got up to about 1,000 by the time he died.
Oh my.
And as we saw a few weeks ago when we looked at 1 Kings, that eventually led to his downfall because it drew him away from God. So it is not to be you taken lightly. It is not to be something that we lavish on everyone who comes along. After we're married, it's only for our spouse. It is something that should be continually protected and enjoyed and encouraged in a marriage through the expression of romantic love, something that should not be allowed to die and wither. And yeah, it might not always be as passionate as it was at the start, where you can tell these guys are still on their honeymoon as he writes for Song of Solomon. But it should not go away. It should be nourished through those expressions of love. And to completely rip off a book called The Five Love Languages, there's different, good book, read it if you get the chance. It lists some ways that different people express love, romantic love. It includes gift giving. Some people, you know, they're just really good at knowing what the other person likes and find just the right thing to give them. It's not that you're trying to bribe them, it's that you know what they like and you want to make them happy by giving them something that they're really going to appreciate, that shows that you're really thinking about them. You know what they like and you know what's going to make them happy. So gift giving is one way. Another one is quality time. Just spending that time with them. As we saw throughout the book of Song of Solomon, these people cannot be apart without the excessively strong desire to be back together. That's what the whole series of poems is about. Spending quality time together is an important part of keeping that romantic love strong. Another one is words of affirmation or genuine compliments. Telling them that you love them, why you love them. Praising them for the things that they do that are great and good. Letting them know that you appreciate what they have done. Another one, acts of service or acts of devotion, doing things for them, doing things on their behalf. And finally, physical touch, physical intimacy. Again, it's something that unfortunately, thanks to Greek philosophy and Catholic Church and Protestant prudery, has been often treated as something dirty, as something that we can't talk at all about. But God designed the sexual relationship. God designed it not just for procreation, but for pleasure and intimacy within marriage, only within marriage. And it is something that is to be enjoyed and encouraged within marriage. So that is, I said, that last little bit I ripped off from the five love languages. If you want to borrow it and read it, I do have a copy. But that about wraps up the Song of Solomon. Like I said, go home, read it with your spouse by candlelight, because I'm not going to read any more of it to you.